Morning, everyone. Thank you for being here so early. So we're going to go right into it. The story of Roberto starts with a white bear nicknamed Oso Blanco. Oso Blanco is actually a penitentiary in Puerto Rico that was founded in 1933. And the idea of this institution was to have an architecture that was softer, that was actually a rehabilitation space. Now, if some of you may know the story of Oso Blanco, that wasn't the case. As in many state penitentiaries in not only in the world, you can see tragic stories. And a colleague of mine said, if you have seen one prison, that's all you have seen, is one prison. Every prison is different. There's different stories, different dynamics. So the story of Roberto really started before going to Oso Blanco, but cemented there. And I think that's very common. But if we think that Roberto Clemente did not go to a state penitentiary, but let's think about Roberto Clemente, and if he hasn't that story, the story that he had, if he was born in one of the poorest barrios of Puerto Rico, if he was beaten on a weekly basis by his alcoholic father, but he was a natural, very organized leader since very young age. That, in a way, is an interesting combination that led to become a leader in bank robbery in Puerto Rico. And at age 17, which is it's quite a skill, and to actually, he doesn't get convicted for that. He gets convicted for other things. And he serves 10 years in Oso Blanco. And then he goes to New York. And then, of course, the story that we all know, going back and forth in jail. And that's one of the life histories I have been working on. What is interesting about the story is that you can take some of these elements completely out and plug in other factors, and it's the same story. It's issues of fundamental family difficulties at the root of the problem, poverty, access to illegal economies because it's very difficult to get into the legal formal economy, poor legal representation, abusive laws. Like in New York, until recently we had the Rockefeller laws, and now they have been changed, and well, we can talk about that later. A lot of the public health work has focused on this, how do we go from the child to the prison and prison health, which is incredibly important work. But what happens after post-release? A lot of the work has been on recidivism, so going back to jail or not, or trying to avoid going back to jail, but not really a comprehensive understanding of the sexual health and well-being of formerly incarcerated populations. So when our question was, if network issues brought them to risk, brought them to prison, can networks outside prison make a difference? Can we shift the paradigm? So I'm not gonna go into the background. This is the bottom line have been established by all the authors. Latinos are disproportionately affected by HIV. Latinos are disproportionately represented in jails. So our study draws on the two theories, the unified theory and the network enhancement theory. We can discuss that in the discussion sessions if you have questions, or we can talk afterwards. We have a three-phase study. The phase one was a set of in-depth interviews with 40 formerly incarcerated film, 20 of their best friends that they nominated. In the cross-sectional piece, we, based on the phase one, we designed a survey and we roll it out with 200 dyads. So 200 film, 200 of their best friends or social support. And in phase three, this is where we are right now, we finished phase two in August. Phase three, we're doing ethnography and life history interviews of those networks. So it's kind of it's a triangulation design. We got lucky and this was funded by a challenge grant in 2009. This is the team structure, which is, it's an amazing team. I just cannot be happier. Of course, they're all sleeping right now. They didn't come in. We can talk about that later. Except Ashley, who is right there. So the analytical questions I want to discuss with you today are very simple. It's really what we took the qualitative data and we literally map it out with paper and pencil, no sophisticated software, about what are the general types of networks that are there for these groups, and what elements from the qualitative perspective, so that we can then validate this with the quantitative data, what elements increase or decrease the risk for binge drug use, binge marijuana use, alcohol use, and HIV STI risk. So this is what I just explained. So let's go into the preliminary results. We found three types of networks that are relevant for this population. The first one called protective, we label it protective network. And in protective network, what does that mean, a protective network? In this case, means a person, let's say M3, joining a larger group of individuals. We call them protective network because these are different names. One of them is gangs, prison gangs, street families, street organizations. And the primary goal of joining is protection. The notion that I need, that through the numbers I can be protected. So there is some level of peer pressure, but there is a lot of fear. It might be constructed fear, it might be realistic fear. But the idea is that M3 is safer and has a family that X1 does not have. So that's the notion of protected network. And there's some really powerful things that this network have. One of them, there's a lot of information that gets shared. There is also a management of threat, whether it's correctional officers or whether there are things that will happen with another protective network and protecting territory. There is also mobilization, strong mobilization around economic hardship. I don't have money to pay milk. I don't have money to pay food. So there are people mobilize and get things together. Problems, though, you think about the limited emotional appraisal and breakable ties that these networks have. Even though, and again, this is not unique to this group. This is classic sociology of men. They hang out, they do a lot of things, but they actually talk about nothing. So this is precisely what it is. When you talk to them in a focus group, you see something. When you take them out of the focus group, I say, oh my God, I'm very isolated. I'm lonely. And again, there's an amazing thing that, so this is something that we're working with. There's the networks of this, again, this protective network. Again, group behavior, characteristic of such a large network, binge drinking, marijuana use, you have rapid access to heroin if you need heroin. Click is a small piece of the network using heroin. Also visiting strippers, sex workers, but also what we call hyper-masculinity tokens. So doing things to prove masculinity. These things are not necessarily conscious that they're done, but they're like, yeah, you go for it, kind of reward. Now, if we talk about those things, we can also talk about risk buffering dimensions of this type of network, where there is a lot of social control, a lot of control of the behavior and the representation, meaning you represent our street family, our organization, our gang, diagnosis, sometimes in interventions, a strong notion of a reconstructed family. But also what is fascinating is the role of the wives. So these are the W's that plays in this network. So this is a parallel network that is there, even more powerful. So even if you're single, you still have the support of the wife of my friend in to deal with a number of things. So kinship network, here this is conventional wisdom, this is and we see this a lot, the husband and wife, Ego is a film, each of them have their families and everything. This is pretty solid literature that said this would be good, except when you have multi-generational drug dependence. And this is what we see constantly. You see parents, and usually fathers and mothers, who are drug dependents. And then that creates a difficult situation for the formerly incarcerated Latino men that is dealing with issues of substance abuse or trying to leave substance abuse. So in a strange way, a close network actually can be a little more dangerous than a more loose network. And again, this is just different examples of this. Also, another problem that we're seeing right now is when the wife uses substances or is an enabler. So even though the peers, well, you know he's using heroin. You know that's why he's running into the bathroom. Oh, no, I know, I understand. So that becomes a problem. So now, however, this is another type of network that we see. There's no network, really. They come out of jail, they have nobody. And one way to deal with that is to adopt the family of a wife. So again, it's a reconstructed notion of family in terms of sexual network. We're almost finished. The single guys is pretty much, most of them are casual. They have casual partners, but they are serial. It's not really concurrent. You don't see that much. When we see, again, this is a number of them also have a wife, wifey, baby mom, you know, variants of that. Now, this we also saw, which is kind of an opportunistic type of casual partner, just the opportunity is created and this just happened. Now, the more risky one are these two, A and B, which is having a concurrent lover. And this is and again, love and trust is something that doesn't work very well with HIV protection, because then you stop using condoms. And that's what we see constantly. And then there are some of the lovers who actually have another partner too. So this is, it's more dense, but just for simplicity purposes, we're just presenting like that. The main issues is that they are more consistent in using condoms with casual partners. They are inconsistent or don't use any condoms with their lovers. They of course, they don't use condoms with their wives or wifeys. High difficulty introducing condoms once a risky episode happened. How can I, if I show up with a condom with my wife, what the hell were you doing? But, so there's also a lot of social risk. I don't want to lose my children. Children becomes important. Family becomes important. Interesting thing. Getting high and having sex, when they're doing it with the casual partners, so far it seems that they're more self-controlled, they're more aware that, but when it's with the lover, things are a little bit more loose, so it becomes then more risky. Now we're finished, there's a lot of limitation. We need to validate this. We have a tremendous amount of data. We're in the process of cleaning. We're excited about that. Implications, family matters. Drug dependency network ties weakens support and increases risk. Enhancing weak networks under limited resources and conditions is a major challenge. We're in the process of figuring it out, how we're gonna do that. Also, are we focusing on the right determinants? That's a major issue from our intervention perspective, because perhaps there might be other issues that are more salient or determinants that are stronger to predict a larger set of outcomes. Finally, it's can we conceptualize a story for Roberto Clemente or for Roberto C, who even though went to jail or prison, can he be a community leader? Can he mobilize? And I have seen it. So, but can we roll out some of this in a larger way? Can we create the opportunity structures to help in the process of not only reentry, but also in the larger span? Thank you so much.